He's written a lot of scores for, he's written most of David Cronenberg's scores. He wrote the score for Dogma. He did Ed Wood and Silence of Lambs in Philadelphia, as well as Seven in the Game for David Fincher. So, I mean, he's used to this sort of dark material. He's done this dark on Penguin from Fincher, too. I forgot about that. He did an excellent score for that. So he's going to get the dark aspects of this movie and of this story. But the fact that he could write something of the grandeur of, say, John Williams' Star Wars score is just completely out of left field.
Right.
You know, especially when you realize the fact that he actually got his start as a band leader on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Which is as far from this as he can get.
Right.
As far from Cronenberg as he can get, but still. It's a great, tremendous credit to his gifts as a composer that he's able to pull this off as beautifully and really give this series a great sense of musical identity that rivals Star Wars.
Here comes one of the first thematic themes, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
This is the bond between Frodo and Sam. And
mm-hmm. Now, in the book, this does happen to a certain degree,
yeah.
But don't they end up having dinner or something with?
Yeah, something like that.
Him?
Yeah.
I mean, is this before or after they're supposed to hook up with Tom Bombadil? I think it's after, before.
This is before. As a matter of fact, the room thing that's just about to come up is also before, I do believe.
Yeah.
We were talking about Tom Bombadil.
Oh, yeah. Because that was a very controversial. People hated that change.
Yeah.
But, admittedly, I enjoy that. I'm somebody who I enjoy that scene, too, but...
Yeah.
I think for the fact that it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with the story, it doesn't really drive the
story. But, if you read all the books, he plays a key part, you know.
Well, I remember listening in the commentary to Peter Jackson mention that he wanted to keep at least fellowship of the first movie anyway. He wanted to keep it Frodo and... Frodo carrying the ring central.
Yeah.
You know, and apparently, the whole Tom Bombadil sequence would have thrown you off of the center of the story, which was Frodo carrying the ring.
Yeah, and admittedly, I can see that, but I mean, I'm not as upset about the Tom Bombadil missing as much as some people are.
I was extremely surprised,
but
I mean, because, I guess it's not central to the story in one sense, but in another sense for me, it is pretty central to the story, because, he is in the end of the story, and there's some things that he gives them that, whatever, so.
That's right, in the Scouring of the Shire, isn't it? Yeah, I forgot about that. That's right. Great scene here. Great suspense here.
Okay. Aren't the ring rays supposed to be responsible for all the insects,
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't exactly remember what the deal with the ring rays is.
But, according to... I'm referencing, the Peter Jackson commentary more than I ought to be, but, according to what he had to say about it, the Ringwraiths were responsible for, they have this thing with, they have this symbiotic relationship with, with the world around them.
This music for the Wraiths just chills up my spine. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm not mean this, but it's like, damn. Extraordinary music. I mean, this type of music is, I think, probably one of the biggest reasons Howard Shore was picked for this score. Because you knew he would ace this type of music. And it's amazing that the most surprising thing is, like, the Hobbit theme and the Fellowship theme. Yeah. And the fact that he could develop those as beautifully as he does.
Yeah, and there is a chase scene in the book.
Yeah.
But it comes after Tom Bombadil, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole fairy thing, they know, all know that way before.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah.
Well, how many years did it take Tolkien to write the trilogy? It took him supposedly about 15 years or so.
Well, he wrote The Hobbit in like 37 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Fellowship was...
Published in the 50s.
Fellowship was written... Yeah, I mean, he basically wrote it like during World War II.
Yeah.
And it... Fellowship, I think it was Fellowship was first published in 54. Or was it Fellowship in Two Towers? I can't remember. Actually, you know what?
Yeah,
I know it says in the book.
It definitely says in the book.
So, I'm not hanging. All right. Yeah. Fellowship was published in 54. Two Towers was published in Fellowship was published in July 54 in the UK. Two Towers was published in November 54 in the UK. Return of the King was published in the UK in 1955. So, and then I think when they, were published in like the 60s is really when the popularity of the book took off.
I don't know how thrown off I am by the scale doubles versus, you know, the digital effects, you know, whenever, you know, because the thing is, I don't know how seamlessly
Peter Jackson's guy with the carrot.
Yeah. I don't know how seamlessly the two elements were integrated. I'm not saying that the digital effects look phony or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, like I that was just something that kind of, because, you know, I don't have that problem as much with John Rhys Davies as Gimli, because he just sinks into that character. Mm-hmm. He becomes Gimli. He is Gimli. But, you know, I don't know, you know, just the, you know, the supposed build of a hobbit is supposed to be very, you know, rounded and, you know,
mm-hmm.
portly and everything like that. You know, these actors are not, you know, I mean, well, you know, Ian Holm as Bilbo fits that description pretty accurately, but
mm-hmm. so does Sean Astin.
Sean Astin does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but I got from the sense of the book, I always thought that Frodo, if he was going to be a hobbit, you know, he would be like sort of a thinner version of like Bilbo or something like that. You know, he always seems to be.
Well, you know, it's not as much.
Not quite.
It's not as much the build of the actors as much as it's just, you know, you really feel as if, you know, these characters are 3.5 feet tall,
right,
throughout the entire movie.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I definitely think sometimes they're like taller in one place and they seem a little shorter in another place.
Yeah.
You know, it's not always quite consistent. whatever their height is supposed to be in relation to everybody else.
I've never really thought about it in terms of that, because, I mean, I just really buy every single one of these guys as these characters. So, I mean, I just enjoy watching the characters.
Right.
This is a kick-ass introduction, though, by the way.
Yeah. And this part here, before he ends up having the ring on, he's actually singing a song.
In the book.
In the book.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, and it's pretty faithful, actually, with the exception of that, until they meet Strider, and then there are some more changes that really, you know, changes that do actually significantly change at least Aragorn's character.
Right.
Because of the fact that in the book, you have Aragorn has actually been aligned with Gandalf in trying to find Gollum.
Right.
Is one of the things we find out. He's actually got a letter from Gandalf, I believe, basically sort of confirming who he is. And so we find out, like, in the end, who, you know, his lineage and what have you.
You know, this seems a little bit less coincidental.
Yeah.
And it seems more, you know, because
It seems a bit more coincidental in the book.
Yeah.
Than it does here.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
what the
heck? That's a good trick.
Upgrade. Oh, sorry. wrong movie.
I didn't think we were going there.
Well, we're not going there. I just, for some reason...
You just took us there. You just took us there.
Listen to.
It's already too late. You took us there.
Wraith World. I mean, this one, granted, is probably not the most spectacular version of the Wraith World.
Right.
It's probably better to talk about later on, but... you know, it was pretty good.
Just under here.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously scaled over right there.
Yeah.
Viggo Mortensen. What a performance.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
What a performance.
Viggo Mortensen from G.I. Jane and 28 Days.
In a few months, Hidalgo.
Which I believe is not being released until 2004 now.
Oh. It's a stool there.
Yeah. This part's kind of familiar. This part's pretty faithful.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to deliver a little bit faster. but,
Yeah.
Whoops.
That hurt.
Yeah. Just a bit.
Feel that in the morning. Now, you know what? There have been some clever fake outs, and there have been some not so clever fake outs in, you know, film history, and this is one of them that I was just like, eh? I just didn't understand. I mean, again, obviously.
Well, see, that's one of those things that's missing from the book, because you actually see the innkeeper help them switch rooms, basically.
Mm.
Yeah,
you get that. You get that. That's one of the things that's out of the book. But
yeah, well, again, just not one of the more, you know, clever fake outs, I think. But
well, I bought it, but
I think it
turned into feathers. Pillows. I think that's one of the hobbits. What one of the hobbits say in the commentary?
Well, the cast commentary is great.
The cast commentary is one of the funniest I've ever heard.
I love the
great information, but I mean, it's really funny.
So. But there's I love the at the very beginning, Frodo's introduction, and Southern Billy Boy or Dominique who says. Hey, look, it's the guy from Deep Impact.
That's Sean Astin.
That's right.
Elijah Wood was in Deep Impact.
Hey.
Can't believe we forgot that.
It's one of your favorite movies, isn't it? Or what? Well,
not one of my favorite movies. It's a movie I like more than another.
You liked it more than I did, anyway.
I liked it more than a certain other asteroid movie, but we're not going to go.
See, let me guess.
Into the Wild.
Yeah. There's a little more here. And we start to hear the beginnings of the Fellowship theme.
Well, it's a great hint.
Yeah. It's a dynamite hint.
I mean, you sort of great
get role. It the entire way, but it's like you don't hear it in its just glory until that's a different line ring from the theatrical version. Sounds a little more arch. I love how the Fellowship theme just sort of propels you when you listen to it. I mean, you know, just...
You can be listening to it in your car to drive faster almost.
Yeah.
Find yourself driving faster.
This is a little hint that as to what type of people hobbits are. But they have like
11
half a dozen meals a day.
What about second breakfast?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he knows about second breakfast. 11 Z's.
11 Z's. Yeah, maybe two of them, but still
counts on it. Huh? All New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
All New Zealand.
Great theme shop.
Fantastic. New Zealand was the only place they could have shot this.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was.
I mean, what other films is New Zealand known for? Not really.
I mean, Peter Jackson's basically New Zealand's film industry.
Yeah.
But oh my God, what he's done for the country, just by making these films is extraordinary.
That's obviously sad. But this is one of my favorite added scenes right here.
Mm-hmm.
This gives a little bit more of a enlightenment to the love story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking about changes. One that I do know about, you know, just because of all the debate that surrounded it, is the Galadriel Aragorn love story.
Arwen Aragorn.
Whoa!
I'm just gonna.
Yeah.
Arwen and Aragorn. Okay. Unless he's having Galadriel on the side, which I very much doubt, because isn't she's like what
Arwen's grandmother? Galadriel's Arwen's grandmother. Oh, that's something I do know.
Okay. What is the relation?
Huh?
I can't remember.
That's something I do know because of Peter Jackson's commentary. Yes.
I didn't remember it was grandmother. I thought it was like the aunt or something like that. But
well, okay. Listen to Peter Jackson's commentary. May learn something.
I've listened to it. Thank you very much. I've listened to all four of them, and I've watched the other two discs, so. Yeah.
This Lord, oh my Lord. This is some incredible makeup.
Oh, yeah. Weta.
Yeah.
Weta Digital, Weta. Just Weta, in general. I mean, Peter Jackson's own little playground. Basically, I mean, I don't think they've ever done.
And he did, and he that. Developed it all from off the shelf software, if I'm not mistaken.
Basically, I mean, I think that's how it goes. Yeah.
Or at least he started his research with just off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think they went a little outside of the off the shelf world in order to do the first Battlefield.
Yeah,
but
well, I mean that's the first thing we get of Massive,
right?
Which is their pretty groundbreaking software to basically give each CG character, basically their own brain, used to much more extent in Two Towers and, well, inevitably The Return of the King. But, I just love these shots, these overhead shots. Man.
It's a weather top here.
Mm-hmm.
Is it ever mentioned in the movie that this is referred to as Weathertop?
I don't believe so. I think that's just one of those things that if
you have to learn by listening to
those
stories, the book. Yeah.
I do believe they get some Tom Bombadil at some point in time, you know, because there's a whole treasure chest thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I know Aragorn does not give them the swords.
I know you're right on that Aragorn doesn't give it to him. I can't remember about Bombadil. I really don't remember that scene well enough.
It's been
over a year or so since I've read it, so.
You see something for you, Mr. Frodo?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, didn't Fran Walsh do the screech for the ring?
According to the commentary, again, I know I'm like basing all my information on that. But.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I just sort of think she probably did that if would do. That's how it would sound if Peter ever told her he was going to do this Milleron.
Yeah.
Which I've heard is daunting,
right,
to say the neat least, as far as a read.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've heard that from my cousin, who's a huge Lord of the Rings fan and has read, you know, read the book long before I did, read The Hobbit and stuff. And he even admits he couldn't get through a Sauron, so it's like.
Some scale doubles right here.
Mm-hmm.
But see, you know, I mean, but do you get what I'm saying, though? The scale doubles versus the wide shots versus the close-ups, you know, it almost kind of. It's not that I'm thrown out of the movie.
Right.
I'm never thrown out of the movie.
Right,
the movie's
right.
The movie,
yeah.
The story, yeah. And the execution is way too good not to ever, you know, but.
This is Ravenwood.
Right.
Oh, love those designs.
Yeah.
Now, Brian,
it's one of those things where it's like, when you read about it, it's like, wow.
Brian, I'm counting on you to know this, but what were the name of the two conceptual designers on this who were both pretty renowned?
Alan Lee and John Howe, I believe.
Yeah, when I found that out, I thought that was.
And they, well, what they illustrated, the Tolkien, they illustrated the books.
Right.
It's basically, you know, I mean, that's what they're known for, is illustrating the books.
And when I found that out, that the illustrators for the novels were the conceptual
mm-hmm.
artists for the film, I just thought that was really special.
Yeah.
I thought that was just extremely special, and I was really tickled when I.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that Peter Jackson went out his way to get them,
yeah.
to get them involved in this, is, I mean, that really shows you how much he wanted to get this right, and how much he really wanted to, how much care went into this. And it's great to actually listen to him on the commentaries and in interviews on the documentaries and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that you know how involved they are, how much they love this story in this world.
They're down the mid. We got like what I know.
Admittedly, it's not really believable, but and that is. This is another place where there are significant changes from the book.
Oh yeah.
But you know, we get to see Aragorn kick some serious.
Yeah.
But later on, so I mean,
this is one of my favorite single shots in the movie. And there's, and I think it was Richard Taylor in one of the commentaries talking about how many different elements are in play.
Mm-hmm.
It's just absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I can rattle them off if I want to. Listen to those commentaries if you want a blow by blow on it. But, Lord. And I love the music here.
Well, yeah, you were mentioning the Wraith theme. I really have a real appreciation for the Uruk-hai theme. I think that was...
Oh, I love the Uruk-hai theme.
I think that's a pretty essential villain theme right there. I think that's one of the best villain marches, you know, written since, you know, the Imperial March.
I've got nothing against the Uruk-hai theme. I love the Uruk-hai theme. But, I mean, the Ringwraith one is the one that really shows up my spine, and there's another one where in the two, there's another part of Wraith music in the Two Towers that is like, damn, it's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
I love this. Just
straight down.
Yeah. I mean, Peter Jackson, we haven't talked about him too much, and I think part of that's probably because, well, we've got another couple of hours to go. So he's going to come up sooner or later. Peter Jackson is a visionary. It's plain and simple. He's a visionary. Regardless of what you think of Dead Alive, one of his first major...
Regardless of what you think of The Frighteners.
Or The Frighteners, which I actually think is underrated. I enjoyed the movie a lot.
You and I have had some interesting discussions about The Frighteners.
I enjoyed the dark humor in The Frighteners. But I also feel like the movie has a lot of heart. More heart than it's given credit for. Regardless of what you think of Heavenly Creatures, I mean, which was the film that shone to prominence because it was Oscar nominated for original screenplay, not undeservingly. Peter, we're in the hands of a visionary in this film. I mean, plain and simple. I mean, it's very hard to see anybody else directing this. And it's even harder to believe anybody else would do it this way, and with this much care to the story.
There's some additional material right here, isn't it?
Another homage to
the
Hobbit. These are the trolls he's talking about earlier.
Right.
Which, when I finally got that from the Hobbit, it's like, oh yeah, that's like directly from but I mean, character is what drives this film.
Right.
I mean, these films, the story. It's not the effects, it's not the, you know, I mean, it's not the fantastical stuff. It's the character. And that's one of the more remarkable parts of it. Now, here, like we hinted at earlier, here's where some changes, big changes, came into place. Arwen is not the elf who comes to their aid. I can't remember remember the name of the elf who does come to their aid. But I believe he shows up. I think this is about. He doesn't show up at Weathertop, does he?
I
can't remember whether he does or not. But I know it's not Arwen. We don't see Arwen.
What an understated performance, though.
I mean,
just totally under the radar.
Yeah.
Liv Tyler is Arwen. I mean, that's just out of nowhere.
You see her work in Armageddon, and you think, and a lot of people, I'm sure, were wondering, why did they pick her? She really is quite good. She really is quite good. I mean, that it's a tremendous credit to Peter Jackson how good the performance is in this movie. It's also a credit to the actors, but especially Peter Jackson.
Well, and I don't think Liv Tyler's ever looked more beautiful either.
That would be
the fact of the matter is that, you know, she's been, you know, in the other films that she's done, she's been, you know, the conventional, excuse my layman's term, the conventional hottie, you know, and she is just so astoundingly beautiful in this film.
And this is another change in that it's just Frodo who goes on.
I've heard that.
From the river.
Yep.
It's just Frodo,
exactly.
Which makes it even. I mean, this works beautifully the way it does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, oh my god, the cinematography is just blowing me away. I mean, you know, you just look at the previews to this movie, and you realize this movie has scope.
Right.
This movie has a scope we have not seen in a good long while.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, at least 10 to 15 years. Even though I'm, you know, there are movies I greatly admire that come out in that time period that really have an epic feel to them, but still, I mean, this is something truly extraordinary as far as scope goes.
And how often do the images open up like this, you know, in other films?
I know.
That's the question.
I mean, the only film from the 90s I can think of with even close to this scope is Braveheart.
Right.
I mean, that's it.
And at the
you
same
can
time,
see the Star Wars prequels, but, I mean, and possibly Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But, I mean, it's very hard to... It's very hard to say anything even comes close to this. It really is. This is truly one of the most extraordinary epics that's ever been filmed, bottom line. The depth of composition in each shot is absolutely extraordinary.
Right.
I mean, this is... I love that moment. And then it's like, you shouldn't have said that.
Yeah. You're just egging them on there, Liz.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the coolest damn effects in the entire movie.
Yeah.
Which is really saying something.
Saying a lot.
The water force,
the brigade.
The river forces. And they're completely convincing.
Right. Yeah,
it looks like
effects.
This moment coming up is out of Return of the King, is it not?
I believe it is, yes.
That's good.
You can tell, can't you?
That's not authentic at all.
What do you mean, Dave?
Yes, it is for French. All right. Yes, it is from Return of the King, which that's a moment that you have to read the book to get.
What exactly is she doing
for him?
Transferring some sort of life force to him, and
I think something along the lines.
Yeah,
I'm not completely clear on it. And this part is actually direct. It's exactly how it is in the book.
Yeah.
The first chapter, the chapter.
Can I just say I really like Ian McKellen in this scene as well.
Yeah.
I like him in everything.
I like him in the entire movie.
He's even been one of my most favorite actors. I've seen him like a couple of movies. It's like the pretty easy movie.
Great little bit of lighting. I really like the way they light Rivendell in this part in particular. Really ethereal lighting to it. I love the way they make Elijah Wood look. Really makes him look like he's gone through as much as he's gone through in this movie. So far.
was doing.
Oh, one thing I didn't realize the first time we saw Gandalf and Saruman is that this part is not specifically written out in the book.
Right.
So it's really very much invented by Jackson and company.
Was the moth in the book?
Dang, I can't remember what.
Because I know he figured out some way. I don't know if he figured out a way to signal the bird guy, or the bird guy just came around and rolled him. He knew the bird guy from before.
Birdman Alcatraz.
Gosh, I can't remember.
I can't remember.
Because I remember when I was seeing the movie that the moth thing seemed new to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure if it was in the book. So I'm not sure.
I know there had to be some way of doing it, but I really can't remember either.
Let's take that one up.
Yeah.
The moment where Sam takes Frodo's hand is a direct suggestion from Ian McKellen to Sean Astin.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Anderson!
I mean, conservatively type guy. But he tried to break out, obviously.
Yeah.
But I mean, shoot.
He's a great British actor.
Oh, yeah,
he's a great stage actor. I remember Sir Ian McKellen. And it is Sir Ian McKellen, mm-hmm. should say. Mentioning that in the commentary, how they're both, you know, they both had admiration from each other because of the fact that they were on stage, not necessarily together, but because they were theatrical actors.
This is probably one of my all-time favorite pieces from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Yeah, which is hard to say, but it's one of my favorites. It's one of my favorite uses of The Hobbit, Shire King coming out. This reunion between Frodo and Bilbo kills me every time I see it. It's just such a wonderful moment, and it's such a wonderful reunion between these characters. And it's beautifully acted, wonderfully scored, and it's without a doubt my favorite moment in the entire movie. And actually, has some personal resonance for me, especially because of the fact that my grandfather, who passed away in 2000, about a year and a half before this movie came out, he traveled. Like Bilbo, he was a traveler. He would go off to faraway places, you know, like Alaska and New Zealand and Australia, actually, and Europe, and made a lot of trips after my grandmother died, and would always tell us about him. And unfortunately, I have to admit that I was only half listening at the time, and you know, sad irony, it's probably one of the things I actually miss the most about. You know, it's one of those things where you never really miss it until it's gone. And, you know, this sort of reminds me of sort of like it's sort of the equivalent for me of sort of a waking dream. You know, you see yourself projected in the characters and what you're seeing on screen. I really relate to Frodo. He's without doubt my favorite character in the entire story. And I mean, part of that is obviously because of the fact that you kind of wish that you could do what he's doing, but also the fact that there's the way Elijah plays the character is just so wonderful, and you know, he makes you feel this character. He really makes you see this character from deep down. And like I said earlier in the commentary, probably it's the most unheralded performance, even though it's right out there in the open. Just love it.
One of my favorite elements here is Frodo mentioning how he'd always wished to be off on one of Bilbo's adventures with him, and how he's just now realizing that one of Bilbo's adventures would in fact have the effect that this particular journey has had on Frodo, and how it's just drained him in so many ways, and he's a different person now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're only a quarter of the way through the story as a whole right here, really. You know, and it's going to be just so much. I mean, I really admired the development of, you know, the character development of Frodo throughout Two Towers as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to be profoundly interesting to see how all of the characters, end up, you know, the state that they'll be in, you know, the emotional state, the physical state, of just every element. Because you can tell each character is different at the end of every story. You know, each character has changed in some, you know, no matter how insignificant the character, it's relevant.
Mm-hmm. Having read the entire trilogy, I mean, I really envy people who are going into these movies without reading the books, because of the fact that they, and I hope that Peter does justice, I'm sure he will do justice to the character developments that happen specifically to The Hobbits and The Return of the King, because that's one of the parts I love the most about reading that book, is I love where each of the characters went and how their stories became much more profoundly life-changing for each one.
Orlando Bloom, who we just saw in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. This was his first major film, and mm-hmm. suffice to say, I mean, pretty much made him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was the star of the second he started fighting, basically.
Yeah, this is probably one of the coolest characters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little too handsome for his own good, in my opinion.
There's a lot of stuff that's not in here in the Rivendell sequences in the book. There's a lot of stuff from the book. It's just very, it's had a lot of changes, and for the better, I think.
A lot of changes in dialogue. Mm-hmm.
It's nice to see, you know, it's one book, and admittedly, book and cinema are two completely different art forms. I mean, you can't really compare them. And for what the book is, what's in the book works for the book. But the changes, I think, that were made for the film work in the film's advantage, certainly. I'll be back.
But it didn't. And now everybody's the same.
Thanks a lot, Celador. The Celador. This is the first time we get a sense of what Aragorn's destiny is. That he could very well hold the quote unquote key to the future of mankind, you know, and Middle Earth for what it's worth.
Mm-hmm. What's with the quote unquote key though? I really don't get that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know, it just I Because I'm
trying to be cliche, but
yeah, well, that's the thing. I'm cliche.
I didn't say it, but still.
Well, that's why I put the quotes around it, because, you know, I mean, I hate talking in cliches. I hate listening to people talking cliches, but, you know, you're gonna have you're gonna find yourself talking in cliches when you talk about something that you really admire, and
this
movie could have very easily have become one big cliche.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, as I've heard Brian mention time and time again, quote unquote, that in the hands of any other director, this movie could have very easily been one big cliche.
I really believe that you need a director who's passionate about the material, and Peter Jackson is a director who's passionate about the material. Right now, we've just had our first interaction between Boromir, played by Sean Bean from GoldenEye and Patriot Games, and a recent science fiction movie, Equilibrium, and Aragorn, that sort of plants the seeds for the antagonism we see between them later in the movie.
And is only dealt with more in-depthly with the additional material.
Yeah.
But I'm absolutely loving what Liv Tyler's performance, and, you know, what she did with her voice, what she does with her body language, and the way she carries herself.
Well, it really is a thankless role.
Yeah.
I really think it is to the film's advantage that they expanded it and they're putting more emphasis on the love story. I mean, you could simply boil it down to the fact that it's like, oh, well, they're trying to make it more accessible, and, you know, I mean, Titanic made it sort of like where you had to have a love story in a big epic setting, but I really do not believe that that's why Peter Jackson did it.
Yeah.
The love story is really very thin in the movie.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, it could have easily detracted from the movie, and I don't think it did so. I think it added.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely agree with that.
Can I just ask a question? Where are the animal crackers?
Might be smack you when the disc change because of the fact that I'm going to beat the living daylights out of you, Ron.
Somebody had to make the reference.
I wasn't going to because
don't
I hate
wanna
that
close
scene.
My eyes.
I hate that scene.
You hate that scene?
I despise it. It's the worst scene I've ever seen.
I like your stomach, man.
I brought that up just for you, Brian.
That's fine, but I'm not arguing about her stomach. I'm arguing about what's going on her stomach.
Right, okay. Right.
Okay.
The gazelles. Sorry, okay.
You're dead. you're a goner. I'm sorry, but
somebody had to do it.
It wasn't going to be me. I can pretty much tell you it wasn't going to be Dave. So that somebody is.
Who does that leave? Anyway, this is the Evening Star here.
Yeah, beautiful song by Enya.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. I think Enya wrote it. Or, well, somebody.
No. Fran Walsh wrote most of the songs in this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I really do, you know, because Enya is such a particular kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
And it fits within the story flawlessly.
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk more about Enya when we get later in the movie. You know, the end credits in particular with that song. And again, another cliche seemed to prop up as opposed to in epics, whereas, you know, people felt like, well, you need a love story, you also need a love ballad. And so tremendous credit to Howard Shore and company, but they did not go the conventional route with said ballad.
Right.
They made it to where it was relevant to the story, relevant to the themes of the story, and didn't use the same music that we had already heard several times before. They actually wrote a real song as opposed to just put some lyrics over what we had heard previously. Now this is a new scene because we didn't get the Boromir recounting his dream in the theatrical version, but it is something.
And if I'm not mistaken, some of the extended material that's going to be included on the Two Towers DVD is a flashback, involving Boromir.
Yeah.
And I think some of this has to do with it.
I can't remember. Is this part in the book with the black speech?
I don't think so. I don't remember that.
I don't think that it is.
How many pages in the book is the Council of Elrond? I heard it's like somewhere in the realm of like 40 or so pages or something.
Yeah, it's just pretty long. We need all that. Really.
Let's see.
It's about 12 pages of script and film, but
And it took them a heck of a lot, pretty long time to film too. Let's see. The Council of Elrond chapter starts on page 233 and goes until 264.
Goodness.
So about 30 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really impressive thing because, and it is more drawn out in the book, and you do see the little, you see a different angle because Bilbo's actually at the Council of Elrond in the book, and that's actually how it's presented in the animated version, but I think this does a very good job, and I think, I personally feel like you don't need the Bilbo that Council of Elrond in this. It works really well this way.
Where do you get a speech coach to teach actors Elvish, where on God's green earth do you come up with that?
I mean, you basically get people who've studied Tolkien's writings,
you get them to talk to a speech coach.
And then
that speech coach then does his thing.
I mean, that's like one of the most involved things I've ever even fathomed. John Rhys Davies.
John Rhys. Yep.
As Gimli.
Sala from the Indiana Jones movies.
Which I couldn't even believe.
I couldn't believe it either.
Very dangerous.
Sure.
Now you go first.
Now you tell me after I ruin my ass. Those are some wicked eyebrows.
Yeah.
I mean, those are some really wicked eyebrows, man.
We thought we were going to be mentioning that. But isn't a really clever...
Along the lines of Mystery Science Theater 3000, I know, but still.
This is a really clever... this scene was really... really well... was parodied really well in the MTV Movie Awards.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that.
Jack Black and Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Mm-hmm. Some really clever editing and.
Mm-hmm. Sit down, Blondie.
I was watching some of the extras on this on the DVD, and it just showed how many takes it took to get all the actors to interact with each other as flawlessly as they do here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scale doubles, and then the actual leads taking their turns.
Yeah,
it's just mind blowing. This is another one of my favorite images right here.
Mm-hmm.
Is the council, reflected in the ring and then being consumed by fire. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Great moment right here.
Yep.
Great moment.
And I believe that they mentioned on the cast commentary and probably the director's commentary for how, you know, they, you know, having him say they want, tell Sammy want, he's ready to go home only makes this all the more powerful when he actually, when he decides he has to do this. Here we get the first real use of the Fellowship theme, the Heroes theme.
And my axe.
Don't forget the bow.
I just like John Rhys Davies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love John Rhys Davies stuff. The entire. Yeah, I did not recognize actually play Boromir here from Goldeneye until you just mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a really interesting integrating of the fellowship theme with the
Hobbit theme.
Mm-hmm. Quest. Thing.
Admittedly, I was really worried. Well, I'll talk about that more in disc two. We're almost at the end of disc one, and nice, great way, you know, perfect place to end this. And we'll see
good stopping point.
Two.
Yeah, good stopping point.
I guess that seems a little cheesy.
Yeah.
The whole, I don't know. When you compare it to the book, it seems a bit more solid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but,
I like the way it's done. It's all right. So it gives it a nice little uplift, I think.
It's all right.
Okay, are we done?
We're done.